This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know it's a tax case, right? Gay marriage on the broadcast today. Also, we'll check in on Cyprus, just because. And batter up, it's almost opening day, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 27th day of March. Glad, as always, to have you with us. You know, it's entirely possible the gay marriage debate in this country is going to come down to a tax bill of $360,000. United States versus Windsor was the case at bar at the Supreme Court today. New Yorker Edith Windsor was presented with an estate tax bill in that amount after her wife died because the Defense of Marriage Act meant the IRS couldn't recognize that marriage. But the tangible financials that are at issue in this case are more than a tax that only the wealthy have to pay. So we sent Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith off today to take a look at some of the lesser-known financial benefits of marriage.
One of the biggest financial benefits of marriage? You can leave everything to your spouse for free. Dr. Stanley Veliotis is a certified public accountant.
So if you and I are married, I have a $100 million estate, I'm allowed to leave it all to you, and we pay no estate tax.
And while you're alive, you can hand ownership of your house or other property over to your spouse tax-free. Other perks of marriage? Spouses of veterans get preferential treatment when applying for government jobs. Those married to police officers killed in the line of duty receive $100,000.
I am standing on the steps of the United States Supreme Court.
John Lewis is the legal director of Marriage Equality USA. He says not having his marriage recognized by the federal government has been very expensive.
Stuart and I have been together for 26 years. 26 years of having the federal government tax us at a different rate because we cannot file jointly.
Lewis says his husband also pays an extra $2,000 a year to include him on his health insurance, and that money is taxed as income.
That adds up over time, and that is money that we desperately need to save for our retirement.
If the Supreme Court rules the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional, federal benefits will still only be available to couples in the 9 states that have legalized gay marriage. Economist Leslie Schaefer and her wife hope to save on legal bills.
We had the expense of hiring a lawyer to make sure that we wrote a lot of contracts to cover ourselves because we don't have the automatic benefits that you get when you're married.
In addition to federal benefits, Schaefer is also hoping for savings on a smaller scale, like renting a car.
Some of them treat us as spouses and some don't, so you have to pay extra to have a second driver. There's tiny little things all the time.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Out in St. Louis today, Panera Bread expanded its experiment in pay-what-you-want pricing. It's going to let customers in 48 of its locations around town name their own price for a bowl of turkey chili. Panera's been running pay-what-you-want cafes in 5 cities the past couple of years. What profits there are go to hunger relief charities. From St. Louis, Adam Allington explores how the business model's working out for him so far.
The lunchtime crowd at a Panera in downtown St. Louis is a busy scene, and on a cold day, more than a few have opted for the turkey chili for the bargain price of whatever they want to pay. The suggested price is just under $6, but Melissa Strohmeyer paid more.
So I gave a 20, and I thought, wow, that's a lot of money. And I'm like, no, it's not.
Strohmeyer likes the idea that the extra money she paid is going to a good cause, and customers like her are not uncommon. Kate Antonacci heads Panera's Societal Impact Initiative.
We find that about 60% of people leave what we ask. About 20% leave more, and about 20% leave less, or significantly less, or nothing.
Antonacci says the program more than pays for itself. But if you're thinking, yeah, just watch Panera try and pull this off with all the freeloaders in my neighborhood, well, just hold on a second.
So on the spectrum between completely crazy and marketing genius, where would you say this falls?
I think it falls closer to marketing genius.
Celine Malkich is a professor of marketing at Washington University. She says when Panera gives customers the choice to do the right thing, it's engaging an important part of human behavioral psychology called self-signaling.
So you're more likely to say, I am the type of person who gives to charity. So given that customers, as people, we have that need, to the extent that as a company you can tap into it, it's going to work.
For now, Panera isn't planning to roll out the pay-what-you-want pricing at all its 1,600 cafes. It wants to see how the idea plays in St. Louis first. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
The beautiful part about Wall Street is that you get to pay what you want every single day. Or not. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You gotta figure that way up high on the list of the worst jobs in the world this week is being a banker in Cyprus, right? Tomorrow's a big day over there. Banks are supposed, and I use that word advisedly, supposed to reopen after the bailout crisis first went from frying pan to fire 11 days ago. It's going to be a test not only of the banking system, but also of whether the Cypriot government's plan to stop a run on those same banks is going to work. And perhaps we'll get a clue as to exactly how much Russian cash is still on deposit there. One thing, though, is clear already. The reputation that Cyprus has as a safe haven for dodgy cash is never going to be the same. So where, oh, where will money launderers go now? From the European Desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Cyprus was famous for the sandwich. It's not a gastronomic delicacy, but a device for hiding money. A Cypriot company stuffed with Russian cash is acquired by another corporation in Belize and then covered by many other layers of ownership in places like Switzerland, Luxembourg, Andorra, the whole thing winding up back in Cyprus.
Moving the money from one jurisdiction to another, it makes it very much harder for investigators to get to the roots of who's behind the money and where the money comes from in the first place.
John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network, which campaigns against tax evasion. He says there's little doubt Cyprus has been heavily engaged in the sandwich business.
My own investigations have told me that very clearly that for many decades Cyprus has been principally a money laundering centre. I have no doubt whatsoever about that.
But its money laundering days must be numbered. So where can those dodgy Russian investors turn to now that the Cyprus sandwich is off the menu?
Switzerland would be probably number one on my list if I were in that, you know, criminal community.
James S. Henry is an economist and reporter who's investigated the best places for tax evaders and money launderers to stash their cash.
You can invest in gold and put it in Swiss vaults. That's a traditional kind of store of wealth for folks who just want a secure, safe haven for their ill-gotten gains.
In fact, there are dozens of countries more than happy to accept suspect cash, from tiny Nauru in the South Pacific to the Caymans in the Caribbean. And oiling the wheels of this vast money laundering machine is an army of lawyers and accountants based in some surprising places. Amy Barry is with the campaign group Global Witness. She says a recent study by the World Bank of 200 major cases of corruption was revealing.
Over 70% of those cases had used shell companies to disguise the identity of the beneficial owners. And of those companies, the majority of them were registered in the United States.
Montana, Wyoming, and Nevada are reported to be centres for setting up these shell companies. The City of London is another major conduit for dirty cash. And, says John Christensen, here's the ultimate irony, Cyprus's sternest critic, Germany, is also tainted.
Frankfurt, for a long time, has been attracting illicit financial flows from across the world. So Germany is not squeaky clean.
Germany's unspoken message to Cyprus seems to be, we don't mind bailing out our own money launderers, but we're not bailing out yours. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
If your internet connection has seemed especially slow this week, Netflix streaming a bit sluggish perhaps, or email acting up, it could be because of a cyber spat that's broken out between two companies you have likely never, ever heard of. Spam House is a nonprofit that's become a go-to source for people looking to rid the world of spam. They have blacklisted a Dutch web company called Cyberbunker. Cyberbunker boasts it's going to let anyone, terrorists and child pornographers excluded, so almost anyone, use its servers to do almost anything they want, spam very much included. Anyway, the upshot is that Cyberbunker has decided to fight back against the blacklisting by attacking the very architecture of the internet itself. John Markoff wrote about the fight in the New York Times today. John, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
These two groups, the Spam House and the Cyberbunker group, I mean, who are they? Are they companies? Are they loose affiliations?
Well, Spam House is a regular nonprofit, and they send out this regular, very large list of known spammers. And it's used widely in the internet community as an aid to blocking spam and other kinds of malware. The Spam House blacklist might touch as many as 2 billion internet users who use email.
Wow.
Then it gets kind of murky. I found an individual who said he was associated with Cyberbunker and that he wasn't actually doing the attacks, but he knew the attackers.
So we don't really know who's doing what.
That's right.
As with so much in cybersecurity and cyber warfare.
On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. It's still true.
That's right. This is, as you say in your piece in the paper today, a squabble between two groups that has become the biggest spam / denial of service attack in the internet ever.
That's right. This type of attack, which is referred to as distributed denial of service attack, has really been around on the internet for years and years and years. This one was really quite remarkable. They reached data flows. That means bits coming from all over the internet being directed at a very, in this case, an individual target of 300 billion bits a second, which is just a huge amount of data. Even the backbone, those are the internet service companies, they barely have that kind of carrying capacity.
Could anybody do this? I mean, if I wanted to fire up a computer and, link up with Cyberbunker, could I do that?
Definitely. DDoS attacks are not magic. There are lots of instruction manuals on the internet that would allow you as an individual with a computer, a home computer, to do this. So that's one of the problems.
Why is this happening? I mean, are they just doing it because they can?
Well, I mean, the specific why is this group is unhappy with the fact they were blocked by Spam House. The broader issue about DDoS is that it's an artifact of both the great strengths and the great weaknesses of the internet. It's a relatively open environment. And in this case, there are two particular problems. One of them is that a lot of the big internet providers have not made a simple change that would make it much more difficult to do this. If you simply filtered the packets that left the big internet providers, and if they checked to say, does this packet really come from me?
Yeah.
Then it would make it much harder to do these DDoS attacks.
With all respect, I'm sure you're a smart enough guy, but you can't be the smartest guy in the room who's ever thought of this. Why aren't the companies doing it? Why aren't those big providers doing this?
There are some complex issues here. Like in some cases, the bits don't come from the big internet provider's own users. They transit through, and that makes it a little bit more difficult to do the configuration and engineering. But I think the real case is just laziness.
Is there a way to know how many people might have been affected by this whole thing?
You know, I asked that question yesterday, and One of the security companies said that clearly millions of people might have been affected, but would you have noticed it? I mean, how many days do you find that your internet connection is slower than it was yesterday? I mean, it happens all the time, and figuring out who's to blame is extremely difficult.
John Markoff, he's a senior writer in the science section at the New York Times. John, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Coming up.
I'm going to eat my hat if any lady has to stand in line.
I promise. It's a baseball story. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, it's the mixed music, but things were more down than up today. The Dow Industrials chipped off 0.2%, about 33 points, 14,526 at the bell. The NASDAQ picked up 0.1%, that is 4 points, 3256, the number you're looking for there. The S&P 500 ended in negative territory, losing less than a point, finished at 1562. Financials kind of a mixed bag. Goldman Sachs added 0.8%, Morgan Stanley advanced 0.3%. Insurers were feeling healthy after news that Medicare payments could increase. Humana shot up 3% today. United Health Group padded on 1.75%. Aetna ticked up about 0.5% or so. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.84%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its final gross domestic product report for the fourth quarter. The American Atheists annual national convention gets underway in Austin. The organization is marking its 50th anniversary. And the Craft Brewers Conference and Brew Expo America continues in the nation's capital. Makes you think about changing your line of work, huh? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Here's today's mind-blowing statistic on Chinese demographics. Economists predict that in 25 years, 1 billion people are going to be living in Chinese cities. It is kind of a logical extension of that country's mass migration and urbanization that's been going on for almost a generation now. But more and more Chinese young people are saying to heck with the consumerism and the pollution and all the other pressures of urban life. They're quitting their jobs and going back to the farm. Here's our man in China, Rob Schmitz.
After she graduated from a top Beijing college, Jia Liming began working as a government official for China's National Sports Bureau. Great pay, fantastic benefits, easy workload, and life in the booming capital city. She was living the Chinese dream, but it wasn't her dream.
I felt lost in the big cities because I didn't know what's the purpose of life, and I felt confused, and I felt depression sometimes. I just felt so boring. The job was boring. Life was boring. Everything was boring.
Then one day, Jia quit her job, said goodbye to her friends, and traded the city life in for this. 2,000 miles away from the traffic and pollution of Beijing, geese and ducks splash in a frigid mountain lake. They wake Jia up each morning. She has breakfast, then she hikes for half an hour along a Himalayan mountain trail to work. She passes by crimson-robed monks chanting morning prayers at the local Buddhist monastery. And then Jia arrives at the boutique hotel she manages here in a Tibetan part of Western China. She's not earning as much as her friends in Beijing, but she says she's at peace. Her friends think she's a little crazy.
All my classmates, the majority live in Beijing. The quality of life is really bad, actually. They have to spend the money somewhere else to take a vacation or whatever, so the happiness becomes somewhere else. I live in that somewhere else.
More and more people are flooding into China's cities. They're part of a government urbanization campaign created in part to boost China's consumer class. Gary Sigley, an Asian studies professor at the University of Western Australia who's studying this phenomenon, says the scale of urbanization can be jarring for some.
While they're shopping, they can catch glimpses on the tourist advertisements and so forth of these more exotic places and kind of imagine that there's a place outside of the city which is a good place to live.
Escaping urban China has become fashionable. In a cobblestone alleyway in the western Chinese town of Dali, a group of urban transplants sit at a table sharing a bottle of wine. It's 10 in the morning. The sun has just come up behind the steep mountains that surround the town. They're reflected in the turquoise waters of an alpine lake below. Xu Yan and her husband quit their jobs in the southern metropolis of Guangzhou to start a wine shop here.
We've met more friends here in a year and a half than we did in our 14 years in the city. The people are more interesting here. They're journalists, writers, artists, creative types. We talk about our dreams and how life should be lived. That's the last topic urban dwellers in China want to talk about.
Xu's friend Zhang Fangtian isn't drinking wine today. He telecommutes here, working as a career counselor. His first client was himself. He's from a big city outside Beijing, where he says he was miserable as a manager at one of China's largest state-owned telecommunications firms.
I was constantly sick because of all the banquets I had to attend. I was drunk my first day as manager. On paper, it was a good job. I own company shares, medical insurance, a pension fund, but I gave that all up for a healthier life.
Zhang and his wife lived in Beijing when their daughter was born. He says the horrendous water and air pollution there was the final straw.
Right before we left, we took our daughter to the doctor for tests. Because of all the pollution, she had 5 times the permissible amount of lead in her blood. We were terrified.
At a quiet bookstore down the alley, Peng Yi Oh shoos her cat out of the way so customers can drink some coffee. Peng, her husband, her mother, and her daughter arrived a year ago from the eastern city of Nanjing. Within days of arriving to the mountains, her mother's asthma vanished. They don't earn much from the bookstore, but then again, Peng says, they're hardly paying anything in rent.
My friends all told me I was so brave for giving up what I had in the city. They don't think it's wise to pick up and move to the place of your dreams until you've saved money, maybe after you're 40.
Peng shakes her head. She doesn't understand that. Life is too short to wait, she says. And in China, city life, with all its pollution, stress, and expectations, can be shorter still. In Western China, I'm Rob Schmidt for Marketplace.
We're a short 5 days away from opening day, gang. Peanuts, Cracker Jack, you know the rest. Dodger Stadium here in Los Angeles is up against it. They're trying to finish a $100 million upgrade of the third oldest stadium in the major leagues. Chavez Ravine is vintage 1962 and very well used. So the new owners who bought the team last year have started spending to bring it up to snuff. And one of their first investments was to hire Janet Marie Smith, the go-to architect for baseball stadiums across the country. Fenway, Turner Field for the Braves, and Camden Yards in Baltimore are on her resume. And she showed us around the other day amid the press to meet a Friday night exhibition game deadline.
So one of the big things about this stadium is that it's, you know, it's near downtown, but it's not of downtown.
Well, in a way that makes it the most unique park in America, because as the trend has been to move into neighborhoods and to do a very urban thing, Dodger Stadium sitting as it does just a mile from the core of downtown LA, but with this beautiful park view, sitting in the most beautiful park in Los Angeles, it makes it just all that much more special.
Is there an element of this that translates into economic boom for the rest of Los Angeles? I mean, obviously there's a lot of pieces of the economy in this city, but does this help downtown, do you think?
Well, I certainly think that it plays a big role. The job creation for the constructions was no small matter. The kinds of facilities that we're building here allow us to do more. There is never a time that there isn't some kind of event, whether it's a race or whether it's a convention or whether it's just the daily tours that we offer, that we don't have people here. And so I think the place is much more alive than perhaps people realize. Yeah. But what I'd like to do is to walk up these steps to the reserve level,
you bet,
so you get a feeling of how we've handled the retail stores, concessions, restaurants that we've added.
Up by the ticket office, right?
Okay, so let me show off one of our restrooms while we're up here.
Because you know what? Those restrooms are getting a lot of press, I have to tell you.
Well, more importantly, they are supersized restrooms.
They're huge. Look at
so
this.
That,
I can't even count how many stalls there are.
I'm going to eat my hat if any lady has to stand in line.
I was just
going to
say, it's a ladies' room, and it's the biggest one I've ever seen. Of course, it's the only one I've ever seen. So, that will be, I'm sure, the most commented upon thing in this new stadium, right? All the restrooms.
Well, you hope so. Yeah. Nobody goes to the game to stand in
line.
Nobody's going to buy a hot dog or lemonade if they have to stand in line afterwards.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Okay, so let's sprint on over, and we'll go up to the top deck.
You got it.
So here on the top deck, we've built a new gift shop.
Okay, wait a second. So the box office used to be like right there,
that's
right?
That's right.
And usually you brought it out, what, a good 50, 70-something feet?
A good 50 or 60 feet. Yep. And then we took the space that used to be the ticket
Did
office.
Did you make it a ladies' room?
Made it a ladies' room, a men's room, and a unisex toy.
I was kidding.
No, we don't joke about these restrooms. We're serious.
How long did it take you to learn your way around?
I'm still learning my way around. Some of these stairs are just bona fide dead ends. Let's go through this stair here.
What is it about baseball stadiums that's attractive to you as a professional project?
I think it's one of the few places in America where you see so many people choosing to mix and mingle and have a focus on the same thing. And baseball in particular attracts all ages, generations, socioeconomic differences, educational differences, and we're all here rooting for the same thing. This building is the third oldest in baseball. After Wrigley and Fenway, and it's the most substantial investment that any team has made this year in any of their buildings. So I think it'll get a lot of attention nationwide.
The number I'm seeing is $100 million for the investment. Is that right?
At least.
Okay, you know what? I don't know if this gets done by game time on Friday.
Well,
there's
we got
a lot of stuff going on.
7:05, that extra Woo! 5 minutes.
Yeah, 7:05.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which the budget cuts make a surprise appearance. Part of the way the executive branch is going to cut costs, as you may have heard, is by furloughing federal employees, forcing them to take a certain number of unpaid days off through the end of the fiscal year. The Department of Housing and Urban Development, however, has said that is just too hard. Here's the key quote from the head of human resources at HUD. The department has over 9,000 employees, she writes. Multiplying the number of employees by 7 days off would mean that there would be 63,000 scheduling decisions that would need to be made. So instead, they're just going to close the entire department for 7 specific days between now and August 30th. So, you know, check before you go see them. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow chipped off 0.2%, 33 points. The NASDAQ picked up about 0.1%, 4 points. The S&P 500 also down, lost less than a point. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.